We're looking at some question and answers. We haven't done this in a while. There is a box back in the foyer in which you can put questions. And as we look at these, we base the answers given, at least I do, upon what God says. 2 Peter 1 and verse 3, God has given us all things that pertain to life and godliness. But we do realize in Deuteronomy 29 and verse 29, there are some things he has not revealed. So if you look at this as an occasion to think, well, I wonder if I can stump Jack. There are two things in play there. Number one, Jack doesn't know everything that the Bible says. Number two, there are some things the Bible doesn't tell us. So if you're looking to stump Jack, no doubt you'll be able to accomplish that. But I will be careful to select the questions that I think I can answer. No, I'll try and address each and every one that is given. I will tell you that there are some questions that I've noted in the box that instead of trying to answer at a time like this, I will give a complete lesson on what is there. One question I was asked, it wasn't put in the box, is what about the Jews? The rejection of the Jews and how to deal with people, how to tell people that today, because that is a question that comes to the mind of many. And we will have a lesson on that probably next Sunday. I will look and see. But just instead of trying to answer it in a simple few minutes, we will have a complete lesson to better equip us to deal with it as we address it with other people. So there will be some like that that will not be answered at times like this, but will be put out. But these are times in which I always look forward to, because I can look and I can address specifically what you want addressed, questions that you have. And as I always tell people, if you've got a question about something, chances are that a large part of the congregation has the same question, they just haven't had the courage to ask it. So don't be ashamed of putting a question in there. There are some things sometimes that people have a question about that others may look and say, well, that's something that everybody knows. Well, obviously everybody doesn't know that. And for those of you who are more learned than others, if some of these matters seem simplistic, well, be long-suffering. And look at it as a great time that these other people are going to be able to strive toward attaining the knowledge and the abilities that you have. So don't look and say, well, these are too simple, these are too hard. We look at it and we simply try to look and see what God has said to answer these questions. I will not deal in foolishness. I will not answer a question unless I do believe that it deals with something that is important. In other words, something that God has addressed. As we look at that, the first question I want to answer is one that we have dealt with in times past. I look back in my records and it's been quite a few years since I've addressed this. But the question is, were there dinosaurs in the Bible? Now, whenever you look at that, the first thing that comes to mind is, you know, I looked in my concordance and I couldn't find the word dinosaur. The reality is, if you look in the English language, you're not going to find the word dinosaur until 1841. I looked that up. The word dinosaur was a word that was conceived then, and it means simply terrible lizards. It was about 1821 that fossils began to be found. People found them and brought them at least to public light. And at that time, there was one that was found. It was obviously large bones that were not from anything that was grazing out in the field at that time. And there was a man who named it. The first name given, I believe, was Iguanodon. And so that word came about. And really, subsequent to that, or after that, you find that bones are found. And each one was given the name, basically, that the one who discovered it determined that's what we'll call it. And so the word dinosaur is a late coming word. The various ones, you're not going to read in the Bible about a triceratops or any other type of dinosaur. Those names were made up as these things were found, as was the word dinosaur. Now there is the word dragon that has been used, and this was even used in the world's language for some time, and we'll address that in a moment. But as far as are there dinosaurs found in the Bible, yes. The way I know that is God created all things. Matter of fact, he created them in 6 days, Exodus 20 and verse 11. For in 6 days God created the heaven, the earth, the seas, and all that in them is. In Genesis 1, you find a record of that account of creation. And as a matter of fact, I believe it was all likely on the sixth day that the beast that would be considered dinosaurs were created. But if God created all things, and he did, and they were all created at the same time as man within a 6-day span there, and it was, And dinosaurs were upon this earth, and they were. The bones are there to show that. Then, yes, there are dinosaurs in the Bible. Now, the problem is they're not given the name. People look and they say, well, I don't read about the, you know, the raptors. You know, this, what was that? Jurassic Park came out. And I heard names then I'd never heard of before. Everybody looks, well, I don't read that in the Bible. Well, let me ask you this. When was the last time you read about a bluebird in the Bible? You don't read about it, do you? Why not? Well, there are birds mentioned. We look and we find God, when he created all things, he set forth kinds. There's a bird kind, the fowls of the air. There are fish kinds. There are beasts of the field. There are the creeping things. He didn't give each individual one name. We look in our idea of species today is much broader than what God ever gave. The kinds in the Bible were the species that God created. Man has made a lot, hundreds of divisions of those, dividing those into species. Well, that doesn't mean that these things weren't there in the beginning. God created the birds. And we've always said that there was evolution of a kind, a proper evolution, that within species, that's supported by the Bible. But it's the transmutation from one species to another, from the reptile kind or the fish kind to the reptile kind to the animal kind that evolution purports, that isn't supported by the Bible or science, by the way. But whenever we look to kinds, you don't find the names in the Bible that would think of. And I don't find anybody, you know, trying to discredit the Bible because, you know, a certain type of bird is not mentioned in the Bible. Well, the fact is there are the bird kinds, the fowls. Some of those are mentioned, others are not. Well, the same thing, there is the animal kind that are mentioned. Specifically, I think you'd deal with reptiles, but you find that in the book of Job, the 40th chapter, I think you have a specific dinosaur mentioned. You look and you find in Job, and this passage is one that people argue about at times. Some of them deny what I'm fixing to tell you, but they disregard things that are in the text. In the book of Job, in the 40th chapter, beginning in verse 15, it says, and this is God as he is addressing Job, and he's showing his power. God had been called upon by Job, in essence, to give an answer to him. And so God had told Job, you gird up your loins and you answer me. You tell me the answer to a few things. That began in chapter 38. In chapter 40, he says, behold now the behemoth which I made with thee. He eateth grass as an ox. In other words, this animal was there with Job. But he says, he eateth grass as an ox. His strength is in his loins. His force is in the navel of his belly. He moveth his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his stones are wrapped together. His bones are strong pieces of brass. The bones are like bars of iron. He is the chief of the ways of God. He that made him can make his sword to approach unto him. Surely the mountains bring him forth food where he and where all the beasts of the field play. He lieth under the shady trees, the covert of the reeds and the fens. Shady trees cover him with their shadow. The willows of the brook compass him about. He drinketh up a river, hasteth not. He trusteth not that he trusteth that he can draw up the Jordan into his mouth. He taketh with his eyes, and his nose pierceth through his snares. In other words, that last verse talks about you can't catch him. You can't hold on to it. You're calling me into account. You tell me about the things that I've created. Can you deal with these matters? Well, the behemoth, some people will tell you that it's an elephant. Others will tell you that it is a hippopotamus. I want you to notice one verse here throws a little bit of a kink into such ideas. As you look at the description there in verse 17, he moveth his tail like a cedar. Have you ever noticed the tail on a hippopotamus or an elephant? Here's an animal. I mean, you see a hippopotamus, one of the most dangerous animals around, by the way. But you see it going along. Here it comes out of the water. It's charging. You see it from behind, and here's this little tail. Ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-ding. I have no idea of saying, whoa, that's like a cedar. Have you ever seen the depictions of dinosaurs? You could get into the specific kinds of them. Some of them didn't have large tails. Some of them, though, had huge tails, like a cedar. I believe Job 40 is speaking about an animal that was coexistent with Job, which is not a hippopotamus. It is not an elephant. It is an animal that was huge, that was, as you looked at it, that could drink up the whole river. It was an animal that whenever you saw it come, it's wagging its tail. Whenever it moves its tail, it's like a cedar that knocks things out of its way. I believe that's a dinosaur. You look further in Job 41, and like I said, people try to explain it away. The only reason is it's a predisposition to, I don't want dinosaurs in the Bible. If you look at that, you come to the conclusion that this is an animal with a massive tail, that is a huge animal, that is a dangerous animal, that's able to accomplish all these things it said, but the description is far beyond any animal you see here now. In Job 41, you find, and we won't read the whole of it, but he says, canst thou draw out the Leviathan with a hook, or his tongue with a cord which thou lettest down? Can you put a hook in his nose, or bore his jaw through with a thorn? You look at that, and again, some people say this is a crocodile or an alligator. Obviously, it is an animal that was in the water. Some of the things said could deal with something such as an alligator or crocodile. But you'll notice it talks about in verse 15 and following, the scales are his pride, shut up is a close seal. It goes on in context, it will tell you that an arrow and such has no effect on this animal. Alligators, crocodiles, they look pretty bad. But the fact is, arrows will kill them. They've got a tough skin. You can buy alligator boots. Now, if you want to test this, if you know somebody's got alligator boots, which, by the way, are probably illegal now, I'm not sure. But if you happen to have a pair and you want to test it, get an arrow and shoot it into your foot. And say, I've got this on there, and the scales of this animal, this alligator, this crocodile, are going to keep that arrow from going through. Don't know anybody who's going to quite test that. You also look in context, and it speaks about the idea of the things coming forth, and it looks like this is really a fire-breathing animal. Now people say, you're getting crazy now. You know, all through the middle centuries, you read about dragons. And people say, well, sure. You know, I remember growing up, Puff the Magic Dragon. Well, that's not what I'm talking about. Do you realize that there is a scientific basis for an animal that could spew something from its mouth that would make it seem as if it were flaming and such? You go home and you look up in your encyclopedias a bombardier beetle. And you'll find this is a little beetle. And evolution has a tough time with this one as to how it developed. Couldn't have developed. Had to be created this way. Because in its abdomen, it has two sacs. There are two chemicals that are there. They're fine alone. But whenever this insect turns, raises up its tail, and from its abdomen it shoots these forth, they come out and they mix, and they become a liquid that is now boiling hot. It shoots this forth, and it looks like this animal is shooting out steam and such as that, and it's a chemical reaction. Well, I don't see any reason in Job 41 why an animal could not have had that coming from the mouth and such as that. But if you look at the descriptions in Job 40 and Job 41, you need to remember, first of all, the reality of dinosaurs is there. The reality that dinosaurs were coexistent with man, there are cave drawings and such as that. Down in Texas in the Paluxy Riverbed, you can find the footprints of dinosaurs and man that are preserved in the same riverbed, showing that, yes, they existed at the same time. God says he created all things in 6 days. Nothing in science ever refutes that. The earth can be shown to be a relatively young earth, and by that I mean thousands of years, not millions. And whenever you look then, dinosaurs are mentioned in the creation, as are many other animals that are not named specifically. They're in the kinds that are there. But then I believe in Job, he gives Job two examples of those creatures that existed coexistent with him that showed his great power that people just stood in fear of, the behemoth and the Leviathan. And I believe the descriptions of both of those put it out of the realm of the hippopotamus or the elephant or the alligator or the crocodile, even if it was a great seawater crocodile. I read about those and I've seen things on Search for Them. The Leviathan still is beyond that. So you look and yes, dinosaurs are there. Now as to what happened to them, a lot of species have gone out of existence. But there is a possibility that there are still dinosaurs in existence. I can show you in various books a picture of a Japanese fishing crew that pulled something out of the sea over near Japan that looks a lot like Plesiosaurus, I believe is what it's called, the one that kind of looked like it had wings almost, it was in the water. They've got it up on a cable, and they said it stunk so bad they dropped it back down. And then, of course, they're always finding things, whether it be in the ocean or in the forest and jungles and such, that they didn't know existed. Doesn't seem like a month goes by if you keep up with scientific releases that they say, well, we found this animal we didn't know existed. Well, there is a possibility that they're, but whether they're or not, they're in the Bible. And scientifically, you can show they coexisted with man. Then in number two, the question I've got is, where did the many races come from? Now this answer to this question really is kind of worded wrong, I understand, because we use a term and we say, well, the races. We could talk about, I think scientifically, the Caucasian race, the Negroid race, the Asian race, whatever it may be. But the Bible speaks about it a little bit different. Whenever you speak about a race in the Bible, you've got one. You got the human race. In the book of Genesis, the first chapter, verse 26 and 27, God made man in his own image. Well, that's the only race that was existed. It was the race of mankind, humankind. In Acts 17 and verse 26, we find where God there tells us through the apostle that he hath made of one blood all nations. Now, that's troubling to a lot of people. You know, I can remember times in which there were people who were going to get transfusions, and they said, well, what color was the person that got, you know, that gave that blood? As if it was going to change something. Well, it doesn't. One of the things about humankind is we are one race. Now, there is the question, I'm sure, what it means, where did the various colors come from? By the way, I think this was asked by Ethan in class, if I'm not mistaken. But you look, and where are the different colors? You know, you look in this room here, we've got a lot of different shades of colors here. Where did they come from? Well, scientifically, you can either be very light or very dark. You can be what's called albino, and I just lost the word for the pigment. It begins with M. Anyway, it's in your body, and if you're missing it, you know, I've got a spot on my back in which there's no pigmentation there, and it's just no color. Well, you can be that person. I grew up, I knew a young man who was what they called an albino. He had no pigmentation. There are other people, very dark skinned, they have more of that pigmentation. Scientific studies have shown the DNA between individuals, whether you're talking about Asian, Caucasian, whatever it may be, you've got a minute percentage of difference. Well, of course, that goes back to the concept of what God of heaven speaks of. There is of one blood. All men are created in his image. But there is a difference in the makeup of the amount of melatonin in your body. And that is what determines the coloring. That's part of the equation. But it comes from DNA, or from the genetics. If you look, if you have ever been in, we've got several here who have been in high school genetics classes, maybe even beyond that. And you know there are various types of traits that are passed on through the genes. Some of them are dominant, some are recessive. If you take a group, and all the genetics classes always had, it dealt with rabbits. And if you take them and you separate them, you have so many rabbits, and this one has these traits in it, this one has these traits, this one has these traits, and this one, it's dominant, you know, that it's a black rabbit, and this one over here is a brown rabbit, and this one's a white rabbit, and this one's a spotted rabbit. You divide those up, and you can use a chart to determine what the predominant outcome is going to be. But you separate them. And we understand that. If you know somebody involved in ranching, you find where they will begin to bring forth a breed of cattle. You know, maybe it's cows, maybe it's sheep, maybe it's goats, whatever it may be. But you will take, here's a bull that shows this trait, you will breed it to this cow that shows this trait, and then you'll determine from the offspring you're going to breed these. What you're doing is you're controlling the genetic pool, but you're separating them to bring forth the traits that you desire. And the result is you will find an animal that will bring forth certain characteristics because you have limited the gene pool. Well, we're not animals, but we still have those genetic possibilities within us. There are dominant genes. You know, as you know, my family obviously has a gene for being very, very smart, and it's passed on to my kids. But whenever you, if you were to go in this group we have here and begin to separate people, you could get various traits. Some of them deal with skin color. Some of them will deal with head shape. You look at the Asian people, for example. What you'll find is there is quite a bit more fat above the eye there. That's why their eyes have a flattened look. There are people who maybe their ears are bigger. The nose might be bigger, might be wider, might be thinner. The chin may be more predominant, cheeks. You know, all sorts of varieties. But if you, again, limit the gene pool, you're going to have these characteristics that come out. And that's why you go throughout this world and you will find Scandinavian people. Here's a general description you can have of them. Here are the Asian people. You know, and so those descriptions come out. So if you want to find where did all of these variations come from, you need to start with the beginning of the gene pool. Well, that's in the book of Genesis, where you find Noah. Some people say, well, it's all in Adam and Eve. Well, that's where it began, because God created man and he put in mankind the genetics. But in the book of Genesis, the 6th chapter, God looked at the earth and he said, I'm going to destroy it. Noah found grace in his eyes, and 8 souls were saved by water. From that group in Genesis 9:1, he says, go forth and fill the earth. You're to go forth and multiply. Well, that was the gene pool. They began to grow from that family. You find that the time came, though, they weren't dispersing like God said. And so what you find is in the book of Genesis, the 11th chapter, that God came down the Tower of Babel and he confounded their language. Now, whenever he did that, he caused them to disperse. In other words, here is a group that spoke this language. Here is a group that spoke another language. It's real hard to work together whenever you don't speak the same, isn't it? And so what happens? You divide. That tells us, by the way, also the beginning of languages. Evolution cannot account for the number of languages that are in this earth. The Bible can. But God divided the people by means of causing them to be unable to communicate. What do you think happened whenever he divided these groups? You now have various groups in which dominant features are going to come forth. They're going to be the ones that, just as you studied in genetics, are going to now become the predominant genes in those various groups. That's the answer to where the various characteristics came from of the human race. That's a better way to phrase it. Where did all the various characteristics, skin color, head size, brow size, eye width, eye shape, ear shape, chin shape, height, stature, all of these things, where did they come from? Well, it's a matter of genetics. And Genesis 11 tells us how God caused the division that caused these things to be separated and thus various dominant features to be brought forth. And it's a simple matter to simply study genetics and then look to that event and find that's it. Let me tell you this. It is not the product of a curse. In the book of Genesis, the 9th chapter, you find where Noah came forth from the ark. And Noah, this man, He is a great study in what happens if you're righteous and you don't watch out. He was one who found grace because he did all that God commanded. Genesis 9, when he comes out, started making alcohol. Good old alcohol, good for your soul. Here's this man, wonderful leader, passed out naked in front of his sons now. Well, Ham looked upon his nakedness. And as a result, a curse was placed. Sometimes you hear the ungodly statement that black skin is a curse of Ham. The Bible nowhere sets forth such foolishness at all. A curse is placed upon the son of Ham, by the way, not Ham, upon his son, that he will be a servant of servants. Nothing said about the skin color. But it is a prophecy that is given and seen in fulfillment in subsequent generations about their servitude. But it has nothing to do with skin color, nor with slavery in the United States or in Africa or wherever it may be found. It was a prophecy that was given because of Ham's sin. His son suffered the consequences, but it was a separation. If you hear that statement, that black skin is a curse of Ham, best thing you can do is try to correct that person. If they're adamant about it, chances are they might be associated with a group you don't want anything to do. There are many groups that are very, very much racist, and they try to find a biblical basis for it, and there is none to be found. One of the most hated verses in the Bible by such persons is Acts 17 and verse 26. God hath made of one blood all nations. And that's really one of the reasons why some people say that individuals of various races are not human, they're animal. Well, that's not so. The Bible has given us one race. God, in dividing the nations, brought about the various characteristics of those races. And you can see them diminish, by the way, whenever you see in our culture today, one of the things you find is an intermixing of many of these various groups with various characteristics, and it doesn't take long at all for them to begin to diminish. Whenever you start mixing those, you see again the same genetics at work, but it's a combination now in which these dominant ones begin to mix in and become less predominant. And so you can see it both ways in our society, but the Bible gives the answer as to where it came from. The next question is, why is drinking alcohol wrong? Well, because Jack said so, and that's it. That's the only answer needed, by the way, in my household whenever my kids were growing up. But I did teach them something further. You look, and there are several things in play. Number one is a principle of what God expects of his people. 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 21 and 22, we prove all things, we hold fast to that which is good, we abstain from the very appearance of every form of evil. 1 Peter, the second chapter in verse 11, we as pilgrims are to abstain from the fleshly lusts that war against the soul. I challenge anybody to study what alcohol has benefited anybody, society, any society, any time, biblical societies included, and tell me that alcohol is not an appearance of evil, or a fleshly lust that wars against the soul. Whenever you determine that, if God said nothing else whatsoever, whenever you determine that, you find that the only tenable position is that we abstain from those things. Somebody says, well, you can drink in moderation. You know, Paul said in the letter to Thessalonica that they were also to abstain from fornication. Can I commit fornication in moderation? It's almost a question you don't want to ask in society today, but I feel comfortable asking it in the church. You can't. Abstention is the only biblical position given the very fruit of alcohol, what it does. But you can look further. You find in the book of Proverbs, in the 20th chapter, in verse 1, a statement made there regarding, and the writer in Proverbs has a lot to say about alcohol and such, but he says, wine is a mocker, strong drink is raging, whoever is deceived thereby is not wise. So he talks about, here's, you know, wine, strong drink, here's the benefit of it. One's a mocker, one is raging. In other words, it's going to take control of you, you're going to lose control. So God is going to say, here is something I want you to have. If you couple that verse with Proverbs, the 31st chapter, in Proverbs 31, what you have is the words that his mother taught him. And he tells him, he says in verse 4, it's not for kings, O Lemuel, it's not for kings to drink, nor princes strong drink, lest they drink, forget the law, pervert the judgment of any of the afflicted. You find what she's saying is, here's the benefit of alcohol. What does alcohol do? Well, in the subsequent verses, she says, give strong drink. A better way to say it, just be, leave it to those who are ready to perish. Wine unto those that be of heavy hearts. Let them drink, forget his poverty, and remember his misery no more. In other words, you know people who live their life this way. You and I know people like that. What do? Well, I'm going to drown my sorrows. Life is so bad, I can't cope with it. Give me a bottle. And they begin to drink. She is not condoning that. She's saying, here is what the worldly application is. You know what this does, and here's how ungodly people use it, that have given up on God, given up on godliness, and they're going to drown their sorrows away. Same thing would apply, by the way, to any type of drug that is used in that fashion. Alcohol is just a drug. It's not the only drug there is. But she points out, here is the danger of it. A king, a prince, you can't do it because it's going to alter your judgment. It's going to pervert your ability to deal properly with others. Do you know that we today have the responsibility to make proper judgments? 1 Peter 5 and verse 8 says we're to be sober. That's not talking about sober in the sense of drunk or sober, but it's talking about sober in the sense of self-control, watchfulness, able to make proper judgments and discernments. Because the devil is roaring lion, goeth about seeking whom he may devour. You know what the devil would love for you and I to do? Use a little alcohol so that your judgment is now off kilter. You don't think it does that? Why do you think, in my day as young men, I'll just leave it there, why do you think young men would like to get a little alcohol and take out on a date with them to give this girl? So she can be more perceptive and alert to the righteous things that are before her? No. So that her judgment will be perverted. So that she will not be able to make the proper discernments. And she'll engage in things that he knows are ungodly, she knows are ungodly, but because of the blessings of alcohol or any other drug, you can get away with that. In Proverbs 31, it makes it clear that anybody who is concerned with taking control of their life, living soberly, righteously, and godly in this present world, as he says in Titus 2, verse 11 and following, is not going to take these mood-altering drugs. Now, some people look and they say, well, the Bible condemns drunkenness, and it does. 1 Corinthians, the 6th chapter and verse 10 tells us that if you are such a person, you're not going to enter into heaven. Somebody says, well, that's drunk. I don't drink to get drunk. When are you drunk? Some states say it's 0.1 blood alcohol content. Some say it's 0.8, some 0.6. When are you drunk? You know the only tenable position there is? Whenever you take one drink, you're one drink drunk. Somebody says, one drink doesn't affect me. Let me ask you this. Why do you drink it then? Well, it just kind of... The minute you say it just kind of calms me down, just kind of soothes me, you're admitting that one drink did affect you. You are one drink drunk. Now, the Bible does speak. People look to Timothy and they say, well, Paul told Timothy, use a little wine for thy stomach's sake. Well, the best you can get out of that is, number one, Timothy would not drink at all. Secondly, that if it was an alcohol beverage, and I don't think you can tell from the context of that passage whether it was definitely alcoholic or not, but if it was, the only thing you find would be tantamount to a prescription. You know, Vicodin is a very good drug. Vicodin can calm you down, take care of a lot of pain. I know a lot of people who have taken it because a doctor prescribed it. Nothing wrong with that. That is tantamount to what Paul was telling Timothy, if anything. That's not what we're speaking against. But if you're tensed up, and somebody else has a prescription over here for Vicodin, and you think, I've had a rough day, I think I'll take one of these. You're no different than the one who takes a little bit of alcohol to calm you down, who stops by the bar on the way home to wind down before you get home and have to deal with your family. It's taken solely for the purpose of altering your mood, of doing something to help you to cope with something instead of turning to God. And that's not right. That's what is warned against in the Scriptures. It's wrong because God condemns it, 1 Corinthians 6:10 and many other passages. It's wrong because it alters your ability to make proper judgments, as spoken of in Proverbs 31. It's wrong because it is a form of evil, of fleshly lust, and we're told to abstain from those. 1 Peter 2 and verse 11, 1 Thessalonians 5:21 and 22. I've never found anybody who could ever support the idea of alcohol instead of, the only conclusion to ever come to is, I don't care what that says, I'm going to have this drink with my dinner. I can't do anything about that. God can't. He knows people are going to do that. But the fact is, you cannot condone it through the Scriptures. It's wrong. Some people ask also, in this question it was asked, how do you tell the difference between wine in the Bible and wine we use today? Well, I'm not sure what was exactly meant by that. But in the Bible, there is wine that is used in an alcoholic context, and there's wine that is used in a non-alcoholic. Some people don't understand that. The word wine in the Bible does not always mean an alcoholic beverage. You look at wine in Genesis 9 and verse 21. Noah drank wine. He was drunk, so drunk that he laying there naked. Alcohol's involved, no question. You look in the book of Isaiah, though, in chapter 16 and verse 10, chapter 65 and verse 8, chapter 16 and verse 10 talks about the wine that comes out of the presses. In other words, I put grapes in a press, I run the press down, the juice comes out, that's wine. It's not alcoholic. Hadn't had time to ferment. Isaiah 65 talks about wine while it is in the clusters. You ever had a grape that was alcoholic? Not unless somebody injected it. Well, the Bible talks about wine in both means. And what you have to do is look in context. One of the most attacked contexts is John, the second chapter, where Jesus created this wine, these pots of wine. Well, clearly in context, that was not an alcoholic beverage. They talk about the best wine. Our mode today, somebody says, that's the best wine. We ought to, strongest, knock your head off whenever you take a drink of it. No, in the first century, the best wine was considered the freshest. And you look in context, and you'll find really that's what's being spoken of. And then secondly, if Jesus created an alcoholic beverage, the basis that the head of the feast said, you know, you've saved this for the last because everybody is already well drunken. If that's an alcoholic beverage, you have Jesus creating, given their definitions of these things, and that doesn't mean they were drunk. It just means simply they had coated their taste buds to where they couldn't discern things much anymore. But whenever you look, if that was that they were drunk, you have the Lord himself making about 100 gallons, more than 100 gallons, of wine for a drunken group. You go back to Hosea, we don't have a Savior because he has now sinned himself. John, the second chapter, in the context, there's no way possible that word wine is alcoholic. Same with Acts, the second chapter, whenever they said these are drunken on new wine. That would have been, again, the fresh juice. They were mocking them, likely because they were known not to drink alcoholic beverages, and now they've got drunk on the best stuff, the fresh stuff. So you look in the Scriptures, it's a matter of context that is there. And then the last question. Since Jesus is the only begotten Son of God, explain the term sons of God in Job 1 in verse 6. Well, I'll go farther than that. In the book of Genesis, the 6th chapter, you find the statement made referring to the sons of God saw the daughters of men. In Job 1, 6, it talks about the time at which the sons of God went before God, speaking about the time in which the devil went before God himself. In John 1, in verse 12, we obey the word, as many as receive these, have the power to become sons of God. Romans 8, verse 14, speaks about sons of God. Philippians 2, verse 15, sons of God. In each context, what's he talking about? He's talking about righteous individuals. He is not talking about a divine being. Now, we look at that, and it does cause us to give pause, because Jesus is divine. How do you describe it? The Son of God. Well, how could they be called sons of God? Well, the term sons of God is used for righteous individuals. Throughout the Scriptures, that's consistent use of it. As we adhere to the things of God and follow Him, we are sons of God. Children of God is another way to phrase it in Galatians 3, 26 and 27, that whenever we are baptized into Christ, we put on Christ. Verse 26, he says that we have become children of God by faith in Christ Jesus because of our baptism. But that children of God, the sons of God, is an identity of a relationship. I have a familial relationship with God above because of my adherence to His will. And each one of those passages talks about such individuals, whether it be here on earth or Job 1 and verse 6, talks, I believe, about spiritual beings. But you look and it's just a phrase that describes those individuals. Now, in contrast to that, you find in Daniel 3 and verse 25, whenever Daniel was cast into the fiery furnace, that Nebuchadnezzar looked and he said, "Behold, I see one as the Son of God." Notice not sons, plural, but the Son of God standing there. You find in Matthew the 4th chapter, Matthew the 8th chapter, in verse 29, Matthew 14, 33, Matthew 6, or 26, 63 and following, where Jesus is referred to as the Son of God. Now this is a distinct title given unto Him, contrasted from the sons of God, which identifies righteous individuals such as you and I here today. In Matthew the 26th chapter, in verse 63 and following, Jesus was asked, you know, tell us the truth. Are you the Son of God? He had claimed to be, and they wanted Him to be accused of this, and He said, "Thou sayest." In other words, He accepted it. In the very next few verses, they're trying to condemn Him, put Him to death, because He made Himself equal with God. The term Son of God is used consistently in the Scriptures as referring to Him as one who is a divine being. The term sons of God is used consistently in the Scriptures referring to righteous individuals who are adhering to God's will. So there's a distinction. You need to notice the plurality with the singular. Specifically, the Son of God always refers to Jesus and always has reference to His divinity, that He is set apart from anybody else. He's not just a righteous individual. Though He was righteous, He was tempted and always like as we, yet without sin. But He is far above that. He is the only one whom the God of heaven has looked down, as a Hebrew writer said, and this day, "This is my Son." Nobody else can make that claim. So there is a contrast, and the main thing you would look for is the plurality versus the singular. One last passage on that, 1 John 3 and verse 1. As we look at that, the writer says, "Behold what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us, that we should be called the sons of God." You think about that. A title that is so close to what Jesus Himself is as that divine being. But still, it gives us a relationship. As you consider this tonight, I know a lot of these questions are interesting and such, but we need to point our mind back again now to our relationship with God. Am I one who could be pictured as the sons of God? Well, God in His love has made that possible. But His love to us asks us to return love to Him. We love Him because He first loved us, John tells us. And if we love Him, we keep His commandments. And whenever we obey His will and having faith, repenting of our sins, confessing Him before others, and being baptized, that's whenever we enter into Christ and we are now children of God. I can now be called, amongst others, the sons of God. And what a grand privilege that is. Tonight, if you have not availed yourself of that, you have opportunity to render obedience to Him in love. He loved you. Do you love Him? That's really what the question comes down to each and every time. If we can help you tonight to become that, to look forth and say yes, whenever you read about the righteousness of those who are the sons of God, and you look and you say with the realization, "That's me." You can have that hope tonight. If we can help you to obey God and become that child of God, if you've strayed from Him and have not acted as you should, as the sons of God, it's time to come back. God is your Father. He deserves the best. And if we give it to Him, He blesses us. If we fail to give it to Him, He still stands. And He says, if you repent, I'll forgive you. 1 John 1 and verse 9. Whatever your need may be, help us. Let us help you tonight to make it right as we stand and sing the song of invitation.